Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Bruno Oliveira and Adam Powell.
Hello. So, my name is Bruno Oliveira, and I work in the Android Developer Relations team. I'm based in South America, and my mission is to work with developers to get very high-quality applications on Google Play.
And I'm Adam Powell. I work in Mountain View, California, on the Android Framework team.
Hi, thank you very much for coming to our session. So we're going to talk about building user interfaces that work across several platform versions. So by the way, if you want to mention the session on social media, those are the hashtags. And before we begin, just a quick show of hands. How many of you are developing Android applications? Oh, duh. Okay, so how many of you are developing Android applications that work only on a single platform release, say only for Jelly Bean or only for Ice Cream Sandwich? All right, a few of you. How many of you are targeting, say, two or three major platform releases? Okay, that's more of you.
That's great. Oh. But that's really too easy, though. Who's developing all the way back to, say, Cupcake, maybe even earlier? Anyone?
Oh, that's...
Wow, that's a lot of hands.
Very nice.
That's great. So why is this important?
Well, that's a great question, right? So why is this so important? Why can't I care only about the latest version of Android? I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, maybe there are other versions out there.
Other versions? I mean, really? So just show of hands. Who has a device with the latest version of Android? Oh, everybody. Told you.
See, we're set to go.
We're set to go. Everybody has.
Everybody can go home.
Yeah. Right? I don't know.
Yeah. I think that we might actually have a problem with our sampling.
Our sample is bad, you think?
Well, I think it's biased just a little bit. A little bit different. Okay, so... Who has parents running an Ice Cream Sandwich or newer device? Anyone? Yes? Oh, wow. That's more than I expected, actually. Gingerbread moms, anyone? Yes?
Froyo moms? All right.
Okay.
So, right. So, why can't I care only about the latest version of Android, right? So, that's definitely a better sampling method. So if you've been developing for Android for more than, say, one day, chances are that you're familiar with this particular pie chart, right? So as you can see, the world is not exactly made of ice cream out there yet. So any application that's seriously considering targeting most users should work on at least Froyo Gingerbread Ice Cream Sandwich and Jelly Bean, right? But there are developers, and they are among us, who look at this chart, and they're scared, and they say, that's difficult. One thing that I learned in the last 48 hours is that jumping from a moving Zeppelin and landing on top of Moscone Center is difficult. That stuff is easy.
Right. So this is actually fairly easy to do by comparison. And we're going to show you how, just to make sure that your user interface adapts correctly across several platform versions. And don't worry, it doesn't actually involve any extreme sports.
All right, so for those of you who don't like pie charts, don't worry. As you can see, most of this presentation is not, in fact, a pie chart. So, enough philosophy for now. So let's start by being noobs, right? So let's talk about some naive approaches to multi-versioning your Android user interface. It's worth mentioning that most of the approaches that we're going to mention here are all valid to some degree. And our point is that they should not be taken to the extremes that we're going to show you. So with that warning, let's move on to the first naive approach. Some developers avoid evolution completely. They just stick to the good old stuff, forget anything about the new stuff, right? So it's already an improvement over what we would have, say, 60 years ago. But then it looks like their app is stuck in time, because you open it up in Ice Cream Sandwich, and then it just looks exactly like it did on Cupcake, or almost, at least. So sure, you could say, yeah, but that's because my app is consistent. You know, consistency is important. But that's only because it's consistently obsolete everywhere. So... Needless to say, that's not a great idea. Evolution is a must. Now, there are some, moving on, there are some developers that know that evolution is a good thing, right? But they are somehow fascinated with the concept of multiple APK, and they think that that's a solution to everything. So they have one APK for Cupcake, one for Eclair, one for Froyo, and maybe one for that odd device that your boss is currently using. But again, I'm not saying here that multiple APK is a universally bad approach. All I'm saying is that it should not be abused to the point that you have one separate APK for each different platform version, right? Right, Adam?
That's right. So this can really be a workable approach for handling the divide between, say, Gingerbread and Ice Cream Sandwich, where we had a whole ton of changes in UX, especially when Holo came into the picture. But we really don't recommend getting too much more granular than that outside of some serious edge cases. I mean, you might consider, like, a large screen versus small screen if certain business cases allow for it. But in general, you want to try and keep things mostly together.
Now, some developers know that they should try and have one APK as much as possible, but they still write fully separate layout and code for each version of Android. So while some degree of that is probably okay, If you get to a point where you have different layout and code for each major platform of Android, then you're probably making things more complicated than you should. So we don't recommend going crazy with this. Actually, we don't recommend going crazy at all, in general.
Right. So taken to an extreme, this really isn't much different than abusing multi-APK. You're just cramming everything into the same package. You still have the same level of duplication in practice that you have to maintain. So when you split into separate resources and code paths for different versions, it's important to be really tactical about it. So what are some ways that we can do that?
Glad you asked. So let's stop being noobs, right? So I think at this point we probably leveled up to a level 2 multiversioner. So let's go over some basic multiversioning skills. So first of all, there is a pretty common pattern called the parallel activity pattern. It's just a quick and easy way to launch a different activity depending on the platform version. So in this example here, we're detecting whether we are running ICS or above. And if so, we're launching this shiny, cool activity, right? And if we're not, then we're launching this legacy activity. Now, this is a good approach when your activity really, really depends a lot on the newer platform features, and you want to have a decent fallback for the older versions. Now, this should only be used when you have to cross a major platform boundary, like pre and post ICS, because if you have too many branches there, things can start getting complicated pretty fast. Now, speaking about complications, sometimes when developers implement certain features on multiple platform versions, they write separate classes that are mostly identical code except for a few lines. Now, this is essentially gets you to a situation where it's impossible to simultaneously maintain your code and your sanity. You have to choose. So this is not a good idea. Now, there is no shame in using an if. You know, an if is a great thing, and there is no shame in using it. You can do that and still be in good standing with developer society. By the way, if you're worried that those constants are going to break on the older platform versions because there was no such thing as gingerbread in Froyo, right? So great. That's exactly the sort of thing that you should worry about. But in this case, it's okay because they all get compiled to a pure number, so it's not going to break on older versions.
Right. Specifically, these are the build.os.sdk versions that you can refer to.
Exactly. So our first advice is don't be afraid of if. And then, that said, our second advice is be afraid of if. Because if you suddenly start to see those code branches get too big, then we probably need a better approach, right?
Mm-hmm.
So this is what we're going to see next. So let's talk about being lazy, right? So laziness is probably one of the earliest human inventions. It probably even predates fire. Human beings were being lazy long before they invented anything else. So all throughout history, it's been a solution to many of the world's toughest problems. So this is one of those cases. So we're not going to use laziness itself. We're going to use lazy loading. So, Adam, how can we use this kind of laziness in our favor in this case?
All right. So a couple of years ago, I wrote a post for the Android Developers blog that sort of details this idea. So we start off by defining an abstract class or interface describing what the application wants to do, and then we write implementations of that interface for each platform version that layer on the new functionality as it becomes available. So we can use a simple factory method or a similar mechanism to get the right implementation for the platform version that we're running on, and then the calling code within the app doesn't have to care about version differences anymore. So here's a simple example. We've declared an abstract class that represents a few higher-level things that our app wants to be able to do. And then we have this simple base implementation that it can do the job even if it's not really fancy. This is our fallback for older devices. Sometimes you might just want to drop functionality that you can't reasonably emulate or backport. And it's okay if some of these compatibility implementations just end up being stubs or no-ops if there's really nothing more reasonable that you can do. But on a later version of the platform, we can layer on additional features that enhance the user experience for those people running on newer versions of Android. Note that we're calling back into the superclass implementation over here in our contrived example. This can be a great way to just layer extra functionality onto our base behavior, reduce extra duplication, especially if we're not just replacing it with something entirely new. So a simple series of version checks makes sure that we can construct the right version behind the scenes, and then the rest of our code can remain ignorant of any and all version differences. And for those of you wondering, or anyone who's gone source diving in the Android support library, this is actually the same tactic that we use there. There's really nothing magic going on in that library. This is how we've written all the compatibility shims that we've made available so far. And you'll notice that this idea of these really highly focused, isolated cases of layering on more advanced functionality when it's available is present through all of these approaches to multi-versioning that we're talking about today. If you factor out all these things into smaller, more isolated components within your app, it stays a whole lot easier to maintain than trying to use some big overarching approach that involves a lot of duplication. Okay, so enough about laziness for now. Let's talk about something that's not so lazy. Well, it does a whole lot of work for you. It does let you still be lazy, though. So we're, of course, talking about the Android developer's best friend, the resource system. So a great tool for you to be aware of if you're not already is the version qualifier for your resource directories. The naming scheme looks a lot like this. So you can use this to offer alternate versions of your layouts, your drawables, styles, and way more than that, depending on what platform version the device is currently running. But like everything else that we're talking about today, it's important to use this in moderation. Again, if you take it to an extreme, you get a lot of XML duplication, which is just as bad as other code duplication. So what are some strategies we can use to avoid some of that?
So the first strategy is using Boolean resources. So a Boolean resource is something as simple as the name implies. There are actually tons of fun because they can be true, but they can also be false. The real point, of course, is not being true or false, is that they can be given, their values can be given at runtime by the resource system. So this means that they can actually vary according to the device configuration, like screen size, or in our case, the platform version. So, for example, this is a file called boost.xml, and it's in the values v14 directory. It's defining two Boolean resources. One of them is called post-ICS, and the other one is called pre-ICS. Now, because this is in the values v14 directory, these are only going to apply to devices running Ice Cream Sandwich or above. Now, likewise, we have the boost.xml file in our unqualified values directory. This one has the opposite value. So this is only going to apply when the device is running a version of Android that's prior to Ice Cream Sandwich. Now, of course, you could use a Boolean resources directly like this using getBoolean, right? There is nothing wrong with that, and that might be useful in some cases. But the most interesting thing about Boolean resources, and it's not that they can be true or false, is that you can actually enable or disable components according to the platform version, like this. For example, app widgets, right? So who here has written an app widget? Actually, well, lots of people have written app widgets, and I did too. So an app widget is essentially just a broadcast receiver with some special data in it, right? So if you've written one, you know it looks like this. The problem is, if you do it just like that, it's going to look the same and behave the same for all the platform versions. But what if we wanted to provide a different version for, say, devices running ICS or above?
Can we use a Boolean resource?
Yes, we can. Glad you asked. Exactly. So we have to define two app widgets. First, let's define the pre-ICS one. So for the pre-ICS one, we just set Android enabled to bool pre-ICS. So this means that it's going to be true if and only if we're running on a pre-ICS device. Likewise, we're going to do the same for post-ICS. So for my post-ICS widget, I set Android enabled to bool post-ICS. And that's going to be true if and only if I'm running on a device that's running ICS or above. Both widgets, of course, go into my application's manifest. And the magic of this is that the correct one is going to be automatically activated depending on the platform version that you're running on. But that's for app widgets, right? So what if you wanted to have a fallback like that, but for an activities user interface? So in this case, what you need is a UI fallback, which is a technique that you can use when there are certain parts of your layout that you would like to do differently depending on the platform version that you're running on. For example, in this example, we're going to use this technique to present the new and awesome switch widgets on ICS, right? And then on the same application, same layout, we're going to display the good old classic checkbox on the older versions, right? So how do we do that? Well, we could do that using like two separate layout files. Everybody knows how to do that, but that would be no fun, right? The whole point is to have a single main layout file and then pull bits and pieces from the other files as appropriate. Here's what our main layout file would look like. These comments in green are the parts that don't depend on the platform version. For example, that text view, right? But for the part that does depend on the platform version, we're using a layout include. We're pulling another layout by its ID, by the desserts ID. So this means that we can supply different versions of that included layout that's going to depend on the version that we're running. So how do we do that? We place two different versions of our desserts.xml file. One of them is in the layout directory, unqualified, right? And the other one is in the layout V11 directory. So if I'm running on ICS or above, it's the right-hand size that's going to kick in, so with the switches. If I'm running on a device that's pre-ICS, it's the left-hand side that's going to kick in, and it's going to run with the checkboxes. So that just gets plugged in into the right place in our main layout because of the layout include. One thing to note on the code is that you should always be aware of whether you're dealing with a switch or a checkbox. You could branch on platform version and then cast to the appropriate classes, but that's difficult. Instead, you can just realize that they both derive from compound button and just do it like that, which is much easier, of course. In all cases, remember that this trick is not just limited to widget fallbacks. Layout includes are actually a very powerful tool, and they can always be used when you have sections of your layout that should be different depending on device configuration. So platform version, screen size, anything else that you can describe with a device configuration, you can use layout includes. All right, so let's move on to another very important topic. So sure, we're developers, right? So we are focused on making stuff that works. We like stuff that works. But legend has it that users also care about looks. Go figure. So let's talk about how you can make sure that your themes work across platform versions. So in this way, you can make your app look great regardless of what release you're running on. So Adam, how can we do that?
All right. Well, I'm glad you asked. So on a Nexus device today, you have basically four themes that users might see on a regular basis. And in the long run, we'd really like to get this down to two. But there will always be a few legacy apps that users really don't want to let go of. And by the way, creating any sort of more modern replacement for some of those that are still floating around, great opportunity. There's also the device default themes, which on a Nexus device, they just simply alias to the Holo themes. So we're going to mostly talk about those for now. But a theme, really at its core, is just a bundle of defaults. It's just a style that's applied at the context level, after all. It defines the default look and feel for each type of view, but more importantly, it provides a point of indirection that you can use in your apps. Your layouts probably have a whole lot of hard-coded metrics here and there, like text sizes, paddings, marges, so on and so forth. And this is fine, but the theme also has a bunch of defaults that you can query using the syntax shown here. This helps make sure that you're using the same metrics that the rest of the system does, making your app feel more like a first-class citizen. But between some elements that you query from the theme and other elements that are unique to your app, it can get really repetitive if you use the same value over and over and over. And this is where it becomes a good idea to define some of your own custom styles that you can apply to views. So you've always got a base to build on when you're defining a style, especially if you're going to redefine what a default button style is in a custom theme, so on and so forth. You always want to declare a parent for your styles so that way you always inherit all of the defaults that are there that you may not really care about. But the problem, of course, is that Holo and device default didn't exist before Honeycomb and ICS, respectively. So how do we write our app so that it looks like this, depending on what kind of device that we're running on? The key is in which parent you declare in your custom styles and themes. So before Honeycomb, you'll want to base your app's theme on the legacy theme or theme.light. And after Honeycomb, you may want to use the Holo variants instead. So how can we do that? And really, the same goes for the widget styles. The simplest way to do this that comes to mind for most developers is to just redeclare the styles in a resource overlay for V11, right? Well, of course, that gets into the same problem of duplication again. A better way is to declare a base style that varies by version, and then keep your main customizations in a style that derives from that instead. So you get this simple declaration here to declare a parent that will be selected at runtime, and you can keep all the customizations that are unique to your app in one place rather than duplicate them. And by doing this, we've separated out what's unique about different Android versions and we're targeting, or the different Android versions that we're targeting, and separating those from how our app differs from that base. So, if a theme is just a big ball of metadata about defaults, can we create our own attributes that we can query from later? Maybe this will be helpful for us. And the answer, of course, is that yes, we can. This is especially helpful when there are new attributes available in newer versions of the platform, but that they didn't exist before that. So you can create a simple shim attribute of your own in one place and get the right behavior everywhere. So here's a quick example of adapting the selectable item background attribute that was introduced in Honeycomb across multiple platform versions. By convention, we always declare theme attributes in a file named adders.xml in the res values directory, and then we assign values to the new attribute in our app's theme declarations. If we're using the tactic from earlier with a base theme that varies by platform version, then we can put declarations that bridge the version gaps like this in the base themes rather than the theme that actually declares our app's own customizations. So there are still going to be device-specific skins out there to consider when you build your UI, so when is it appropriate to use each theme? So as of Ice Cream Sandwich, Holo is a stable base. You can always count on it being there, and we've designed it to be easy to work with, and we kind of like it. So device default is a little bit less predictable, but this is how you can integrate with all the various device skins if you're willing to query the theme for just about everything that you do. There are very few assumptions that you can make here, but it can give you a very native-looking experience if you're willing to work with it. When it comes to the layout and structure of your content, on the other hand, following the guidelines on the Android design site is still a really great place to start, regardless of what theme you're using. With very few exceptions, you should always try and keep structure and interaction patterns consistent across different themes and versions of the platform. Bruno, can you give us some tips about some of those cases?
Sure. So let's talk a little bit about the support library and beyond. So one of the great tools, they are great tools to help you keep a consistent user experience patterns across multiple platform versions. So these will greatly simplify your work.
That's right. And in just a few weeks, we're about to make available some more tools that will encapsulate a lot of this stuff that we've been talking about today for the commonly used components, things like the selectable item background that we mentioned. So AppCompat is a new addition to the support library to join the existing V4 and V13 components that you're probably already familiar with. While the parts of the support library that we've already released provide this abstract box of tools for you to work with for building your multi-versioned apps, AppCompat elements are designed to help you follow the Android design guidelines across those multiple platform versions.
All right, so one of the components that the support library can help you with is fragments. Fragments are modular units of composition within an activity. So multiple fragments can be combined together to form a single layout. And they're actually a great way to manage user interfaces that work on phones and tablets. Now, fragments are not an ICS feature, right? They are so useful that we've made them available all the way back to Honeycomb, right? So, So, Adam.
Yeah. So what do we do? Well, I mean, everybody likes Froyo, right? So as you already know, if you've been using the support library, you can use fragments on previous versions as well with the back-ported version that we've provided. All you have to do is add the support library to your project and import the correct classes. Then you proceed as you would with a regular fragment.
For example, here we're defining our own fragment class. So this is the same as we would do if there were no support library at all. We simply derive it from fragment, right? And then we override the appropriate methods as we wish. Now, adding fragments to a layout is also no different than you would do without the support library. So it's perfectly transparent in this case. So this is an example of adding fragments to your layout using XML. So remember that you can also do that from code using fragment transactions if you prefer. One thing to be careful about is that you have to derive your activity from fragment activity and not activity, right? So this is specific to the support library. So this is one of the few places where the transparency is not 100%.
You've got something.
Oh, yes. By the way, I think it's time that we talk to you about...
Notifications?
Notifications, yes. So as devices get more advanced, the complexity of things that you can do with notifications increase a lot. But fundamentally, they are just a way to tell the user that something is happening right now or is about to happen, and it's something that they actually care about. So this last part is actually pretty important. The user has to care about the event that you're telling him. So before Honeycomb, notifications were somewhat limited, right? So this is what you would probably see as far as code is concerned. So you could just create your notifications directly and then set some parameters and then hand it off to the manager. Naturally, you can still use that for simple cases. But after Honeycomb, this became a lot more interesting. So we introduced this notification builder that actually helps developers create them. So a notification builder is a builder that essentially provides a notification for you based on the settings that you provide by calling its methods. So it's definitely a lot easier than building it by hand. So I like this notification of the builder thing, right? So it makes me really happy. But then I realize it's only for APIs 11 and above, so and that makes me sad.
Well, what happens if I tell you that this is also in the support library?
I am happy again.
All right. All you have to do is import it, and it works transparently for the most common use cases.
True. Okay, but what happens if I'm running that cool system called Jelly Bean? So what are the changes? So let's be concrete about it. So we're developers, right? So according to a recent study, the notification builder in Jelly Bean is approximately 217% more awesome than the one we had before. And those are very reliable and serious numbers. So for instance, it includes methods like addAction, which you would be able to see if the screenshot was not in front of it. So addAction allows you to include actions on the notification. So this is what it looks like. So like answer and ignore. And also, another pretty cool feature about notifications is that you can actually use styles. So you can set the style using that setStyle method. And it comes with certain predefined styles that encapsulate most of the commonly used types of notifications.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the naming here might imply otherwise, but the styles really do just refer to these different styles of notifications and not actually resource styles in terms of the resource system.
So this is what the big text style looks like. So you have a title and a large amount of text under it, and then it can be used for like, say, an email snippet, right? And then this is what the inbox style looks like, when you have a content title and then snippets for several items. And this is the big picture style, where you have a title, some details, and guess what?
The big picture?
Yes, exactly. So, and there are several other new features, but sadly, of course, we can't cover them all here because, well, we don't have time. But it's definitely worth taking a look if your app uses notifications in any way. Now, sadly, the new Jelly Bean notification features are not yet in the support library. So if you want to take advantage of this right away and be backwards compatible, you have to do a branch. So if you are, you can detect whether you're running Jelly Bean or not. And if you are, you just use the notification builder natively, right? And else, you just use the notification compatible builder in the support library. So just fall back to the support library. Hopefully one day it's going to become easier, right?
One day pretty soon,
yes. Another important point to be careful about when creating notifications is icon consistency. Right? So on Froyo and older devices, you would have white over a black background. So this is what a notification icon would look like. On Gingerbread, they would be gray over a transparent background. And then on Honeycomb, they would be white over a transparent background. And for each of those, you have to supply the versions for all the screen densities possible. Right?
That's way too many icons. Is there a tool or something we could use for this?
Maybe it's on the next slide.
Uh-huh.
Oh, joy, it isn't the next slide. So surprise, surprise, there is actually a tool that helps you with that. It's called the Android Asset Studio. It can be found on that URL up there. So it generates the icons that you need for you, and even with the right file names. So it's a pretty nice tool to have in your toolbox. So definitely check it out if you haven't used it before. Now, let's move on to another very important topic, the action bar. So Adam, can you tell us why the action bar is such an important topic?
Well, the action bar provides a consistent way for the user to navigate and perform actions within your application. So, I mean, sure, you could go ahead and make up your own way to navigate and perform actions, but anyone who's used a modern Android application these days is probably familiar with the action bar already. So, in the interest of making your app easy to learn, there's a good chance that your app should use it too. Most times when someone calls an app intuitive, what they're really saying is, it works like something else that I'm already familiar with. So you really want to make use of that wherever you can. An action bar has two parts. Navigation, which is usually tabs, spinners, the up button and such, and actions. Actions are divided between the action buttons that are visible, that are surfaced on the bar itself, and the action overflow that's behind that little three-dot button right there. And remember the fit rule from the Android design guide. Anytime that an action is frequent, important, or typical, it should be on screen, whether that's in the action bar or not. Anytime that it's not, then you should think about tucking it away someplace that's maybe not taking up that valuable screen real estate all the time. And the overflow is one way to do that.
But wait, I've heard some rumors. They may be just rumors. But the action bar seems not to be available before Honeycomb.
Really?
Yes.
Okay.
If that's true, what can we do?
Okay. Well, if you're running on a pre-Honeycomb device, you can implement your own version of it. A good starting point is the ActionBar compat sample. You can also use a third-party library like ActionBar Sherlock. But wait, there's also some good news. Soon you'll also be able to use the AppCompat library to make action bars that work all the way back to Eclair, and it'll be as simple to use as the support library's fragments as well. Oh, wow.
Yeah, baby!
Bruno, I think we made some friends.
Yes, we did.
Okay. So, many of you are already familiar with fragment activity and backward-compatible fragments, and action bars work exactly the same way. Action bar activity already extends fragment activity, so you don't have to worry about any sort of conflicts between those. So you'll have fragments available as well. And just like fetching the support fragment manager, you can grab the support action bar in the same way. So the best part about this is that the action bar is really just the beginning of the kinds of things that we're planning on making available as part of the AppCompat library on into the future. And knowing all of these techniques that we're talking about today is always going to be useful, but really nobody likes code duplication. We want to bring the common fruits of all of this together in a form that you can just simply include and use in your apps. Bruno, actually, it looks like we have some time left.
Indeed. So it's just enough time to talk about some miscellaneous tips. Now that we covered the most important topics, right, so the resource system themes, support app, and AppCompat libraries, so let's finish up with some miscellaneous tips that may be useful when writing multi-version Android user interfaces. So our first tip is to, by all means, resist the temptation to style the options panel. The options panel is actually one of those things that the user sees as a familiar anchoring element. And if you make it look a lot different from what the system looks like, that can be very confusing to users. It's not actually very difficult to confuse users. So be attentive to the fact that each platform version has different styles for the icons and the look of the options menu in options panel in general. So it should always provide assets to match that style and try not to change it. It's also worth noting that the menu key is going away. Most of the new devices don't have a menu key. Actually, most of the new devices don't have hardware keys at all.
Well, so, some of them still do.
So, yeah, some of them still do. But the menu key is definitely going away. Its function has been replaced by the action overflow. And it's the same use case. When the user doesn't find something on screen, they're going to look for it in the menu key or in the action overflow, depending on the system. So remember, any action that that follows the fit rule, so frequent, important, or typical, should be on screen, either on the action bar or on your layout. And then anything else should go either in the options panel or in the action overflow, depending on the platform version. Speaking about familiar anchoring elements, that slide didn't come out too well. But dialogues are also one of them. So they indicate system-level interactions, like critical yes or no prompts. So they should be using sparingly, because, as you can see, pop-ups are very annoying. So the dialogues should never be a central part of your user experience. So leave them alone and don't change the default style that they will take according to platform. If for some reason you cannot resist the temptation to style a dialogue, then this might be an indication that whatever you're trying to accomplish with that dialogue should not be a dialogue at all. It should, in fact, be part of your activity or should be a separate activity on its own. So by all means, never style dialogues. So this next tip is something that always drives me crazy when I switch between devices, maybe. So on a pre-ICS device, the default button order was positive, neutral, negative. So this is what we would typically see. So the button that actually does stuff is on the left. And then the button that doesn't do anything, that cancels, is on the right. On Ice Cream Sandwich, we actually switch them around. So the button that does something is on the right. And the button that doesn't do anything is on the left. So it's better this way. It's better. The ice cream sandwich way is better because it reduces backtrack, because the option that the user is likely to choose is already sitting closer to where the user is looking at when he finishes reading the sentence, right? So you should always keep in mind that this is different between platform releases. So if you want to go that extra mile in making sure that your app is consistent with the platform, you should always make sure that your button order is consistent with whichever platform you're running on so that you don't surprise the user in a bad way.
That's right. And this sort of button order layout issue is exactly the sort of thing that we want to provide in the AppCompat library as well. So we'll go ahead and have some versioned layouts that do the button bars in the correct order depending on what version you're running on. And just as an added note, some of you may have realized writing apps that use different themes here. You might have noticed that even on an ice cream sandwich device, an app that uses the old style dialogues is still using the old button order. Well, as it turns out, this is mostly because if users become that familiar with that particular application, not only do they have muscle memory for it, but it's also fairly common for applications to sort of mix and mingle system-generated dialogues like an alert dialogue with dialogues that they've got a custom layout for. And we didn't want to make individual apps internally inconsistent with themselves for that. So it is also important to keep in mind that your app is not the only app that a user is going to interact with on a daily basis. And so as you switch between different apps, you do want to try and keep a level of consistency with this sort of thing.
All right, our last hint. Always set the minimum SDK version and target SDK version in your manifest. And that's important because, well, first of all, the minimum SDK should be what it says. It's the minimum platform version required to run your application. Hopefully, that's going to be as low as possible. And we hope that after this session, it's going to be even lower than before. Now, the target SDK version is something that many developers forget to set, or they just set to a very old version. So target SDK does not affect the minimum SDK level needed to run your application. So it should always be the latest platform version that you are aware of and that you've tested your application against. So for everybody in Google I/O, from this day, this should be Jelly Bean. So this is important because depending on the target SDK version, the platform is going to enable or disable lots of compatibility tricks. And that's going to affect things like the default theme. For instance, if you set your target SDK version to 11 or above, you're going to get the default theme that has an action bar. And if you don't, you're not going to get an action bar, right? So certain other features are also key to that. So if you want to make sure that you have the latest features enabled for your application, always set target SDK version as high as you can. Another example of that is if you set it to level 14 or above, you get hardware acceleration by default on every activity. And if you don't, you would have to enable it individually per activity, right? So it's very important to set those two attributes in your Android manifest.
Yeah, again, and this is just for safety in terms of making sure that applications still run, even if we start making a little bit more risky changes. Hardware acceleration in UIs was definitely one of these. Not everything had the same performance profile in the hardware render, and there were certain operations that weren't supported at all in the beginning.
Yeah. And remember that we don't want to break anybody's application, right? So backwards compatibility is one of the core Android values. So this is why we have target SDK version, because this is how the platform knows what your application expects to work with, so that we can actually provide backwards compatibility depending on the case.
That's right. Oh.